Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for Monday the 14th of April. And joining me on this edition is Hi-Fi editor Ed Selly. From Surround Group we've got Neil Davidson, we've got our news writer Ian Cullen and reviewer Martin Dew. But first of all, here's a message from our sponsor, MPB.
The power to tell a story is in us all. The power to change the way we feel, our understanding, change the rules, how we see ourselves, provoke, change history. Together, let's change the bigger picture. Change access. Put camera gear in more hands and keep the story going. Buy, sell, and trade used camera gear. MPB.
So our thanks to MPB for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. And coming up this week, we're talking about Sony's new lineup of TVs in the TV section. Hi-Fi-wise, we're talking about sub-£1,000 amplifiers. Is there still such a thing? Are they any good? And Home AV, we're talking about soundbars and alternatives to soundbars. Have soundbars gotten you into the hobby? Are you looking for the next step? What is the next step? We're going to cover that, as well as the home theatre projectors from Sony in the EU and the UK no longer being available. So why is that? And this is our 20th year of producing the podcast. And this is our penultimate edition. We're going to have one more in May, and then the podcast is going to take a break. So next month, we're going to cover 20 years in one podcast. What was the hot topic when we first started our podcast? You may remember our presenter back then was Jason Bradbury from The Gadget Show. Things have moved on significantly over the last 20 years. We will be covering all of that. So give us your comments now. Send it into podcast@avforums.com or leave your comments on the podcast thread on AV Forums, or even with this video on the video channel on YouTube. Give us your thoughts. What's the big thing over the last 20 years that you think has happened in the world of AV and hi-fi? And will that match up with our thoughts? We've kind of seen it all over the last two decades. So we'll get into that. And the reason that the podcast is taking a break is that we really want to spend a little bit more time producing guides and tutorials and upping our video content. We want to do more video reviews, more interactive videos and so on for you guys, and obviously on the subjects that matter to you. So rather than putting them into a podcast, we're going to make videos that you can find easily on our YouTube and on AV Forums. So we're going to take a little bit of a break from the podcast. So let's move on to hi-fi. It continues to be a huge pool for people, Ed. Two-channel, you know, the threat was multi-channel is going to come along, it's going to die out, and that hasn't been the case.
No.
You know, two-channel has remained solid, it's remained a fallback for a lot of people. The one thing at the minute that is perhaps putting people off is the price of everything. We won't get into tariffs on this podcast, but the price of everything has gone up significantly in the last few years. And, you know, since COVID, everything seems to just cost that bit more. But we're going to look at the subject of amplifiers under £1,000. Is it still possible to get quality at that under that price point, Ed?
Yes, is the short answer. And it's one of the most surprising turnarounds in an entire industry, as you say, of surprising turnarounds. Not that long ago, no more than 10 years. I think by that point, two-channel audio had pretty much overcome its immediate sort of threat of complete extinction and was starting to stage a bit of a fight back. But it wasn't really contesting the sort of lowest proportional price increments. It was focusing its attention a bit further up, and it was doing very nicely for itself. There seemed to be this perception that below £1,000, you would be using soundbars, wireless loudspeakers, electronics to which you just add speakers, and so on and so forth. So when you tested an affordable amplifier, it was a genuinely unusual thing. And I was struck by the fact that in the last 6 months or so, I've tested quite a few of the things. And essentially, having, if you like, stabilized the situation at more significant price points, it looks like manufacturers are revisiting what can be done below £1,000. Now, before we go any further, I'm going to use the word affordable in the context of things that cost up to £1,000. And I'm completely aware that this is still quite a lot of money, but essentially a line has to be drawn in the sand somewhere. Everything is quite a lot of money in 2025. So we just need to point out that proportionate to the things that you can spend £1,000 on, this is quite a lot of stuff. So we're talking under £1,000, and there's been a significant fight back in this regard. And I thought it was interesting because if you look at the amplifiers that we've been reviewing, there's different ways of going about being a sub-£1,000 amplifier. And there's lessons learned from competing with multi-channel and with all-in-one systems and so on and so forth that they seem to have very successfully brought with them to contest this space. Now, essentially, what's happened is if you look at amplifiers that we've looked at recently, and literally the day we were recording this, the review for the Riga Brio Mark 7 has gone up, there is a sense that they learned a few tricks of the trade from their one box rivals and their multi-channel rivals. Riga is not a company that deals in incredibly radical specs. They do quite radical things with record players, but it's an all a relative thing. The Brio Mark 7 looks pretty much the same as Riga Brios have done for donkey's years, but it continues with Riga's slow progression towards doing things in a slightly more modern way. So as well as analog inputs, we now have digital inputs. It's the first Riga product of any description in any category to have a remote standby and so on and so forth. It just becomes easier to live with, and it is less concerned with dictating to you how you connect to it. It's got the connections for you to connect to it as you see fit. And if you like, the Riga is one of the more sort of stripped back examples of this. We've looked at the Fell Audio amp in recent months, along with its matching CD player. That goes for the same sort of spec as the Riga does, but additionally adds Bluetooth. And then in the same month as I wrote the Riga review, and it's still to go up on the site, we've got the Audiolab 6000A Mark II, which is £100 less than the Riga. It, as well as having the Bluetooth, also then proceeds to add HDMI eARC and more digital inputs. Then, at certain other price points, a bit less than that, we've got products like Rotel launched the A8 integrated amplifier. That's considerably less expensive. But to do that, it has less power and no digital inputs at all. Then, of course, you've got disruptive factors like WIM, who have gone and built the Amp and the Amp Pro. These are really, if we're honest with ourselves, all-in-one systems. But they have enough connectivity to continue to function as an integrated amplifier if you want them to. And all of a sudden, when you look at this category as a whole, you've got lots and lots of different ways of constructing a system that would have been entirely familiar to people 25 years ago. If you want, you can have digital source, amplifier, loudspeakers. Hell, you can go back to 1980 if you want and have analog source, integrated amplifier, pair of loudspeakers. And what I'm finding interesting is how did this come about? I mean, I've spoken to manufacturers and I've spoken to dealers. My interactions with end users is more limited. It comes down to who I speak to with people on the forums and people at shows and so on and so forth. And there is an element of do you feel that you were asking for this, or have you just sort of been given it anyway and we're just going to see what sticks? Because I genuinely don't know. I do know anecdotally from manufacturers that I've spoken to that they're doing very nicely selling these products. So there has to be a latent demand, but I'm unclear as to whether this demand has reappeared after a period of time being dormant, or if it's essentially it's been recreated by people going, well, I've been using an all-in-one speaker and actually I'm a bit annoyed that I can't connect to it in the way that I want to, or things like that. I think it's quite rare, and I've been trying to think about a parallel to this happening in multi-channel, and I really can't, where such a complete reversion to how things were has happened in 10 years.
Do you think it's because it's so prevalent now in terms of wireless speakers, Alexas, all that kind of thing, and that people have gotten used to using that, but then they're thinking, I want it to sound a bit better. I want something that, or they maybe discovered the music collection again and then thinking, well, actually, I quite fancy having a nice system that I can sit down when I've got time and listen to music. Is that a factor?
I think that's part of it. I also think the fact that, broadly speaking, these products are better at avoiding obsolescence, planned or accidental, as well. We are very conscious of how we're spending our money and how we want our money to go. Let's face it, if you buy, of the amplifiers I've been listing there, if you buy the Rotel wouldn't have done anything that shocked me if I'd encountered it when I was 16 years old. The chances are it's going to be completely and utterly relevant when I'm, you know, 60 years old. It's just a row of analog inputs, and you can connect a turntable to it. And as we've established, vinyl doesn't seem to want to die under any conditions. So it's essentially, it's ready to accept whatever changes to digital happen in that time, and it'll just keep working. And if we look back to more integrated software driven products of 10 years ago, actually they're starting to run into some issues now. There's through no, you know, manufacturers can't be expected to support things indefinitely, so this is not a dig at them. But if you've got a product which is fundamentally dumb, and I do mean this in the politest possible way for the Rotel, it's not being deliberately obtuse, it's just fundamentally a very simple thing. You can buy it knowing that it's going to do what needs to be done for the foreseeable future. And I think that there's a sense of wanting your money's worth and risk aversion in some purchasing decisions, which is actually causing a technological reversion in how we're building things as well. Because again, if you spread functionality over a couple of boxes, if part of it goes wrong, you only have to replace part of it. If you want to change part of it, you only have to change part of it. If you want to connect something completely different to it, the chances are there's a row of connections that are relevant to the task of working with it. And all of a sudden, what looked like a thoroughly old-fashioned way of doing things actually suddenly looks like entirely the correct way of doing things. And I think this then goes hand in hand in terms of the price points that we're looking at these things happening. If you look at the Riga or the Audio Lab, or actually you can go right to the top of the price point, Cambridge Audio CXA 81 Mark II, so that's a pound under a grand. And you think, well, that's quite a lot of money. And it is. But then when you look at fundamentally, I mean, the Cambridge in particular, if you really wanted to, if you've got a smartphone and the relevant USB adapter, that can be your streaming front end. It's got USB. It'll just work. The Riga and the Audio Lab don't have a USB input, so you'd have to be a bit more creative. But we've tested products like the Wim Mini and things like that, which are under 100 quid. You don't need to worry about how it sounds, even though actually the Wim sounds pretty good. You just need that digital output to connect to your amplifier. And I think the fact that a large portion of how we access music on a ready basis has become either more affordable or we own it anyway has allowed the amplifier to concentrate more on being the key part of a hi-fi system, both decoding and amplification, and take a proportionally larger part of the budget. And I don't think people then bother to buy that, because the nature of the amount of budget that they've spent in total hasn't changed. It's just been spread slightly more evenly or slightly more differently to how it might have been, where you did equal for source, equal for amp, equal for speakers. It's a bit different now. You can do it in a slightly different way.
It's something we're going to get into in the second half of the podcast, Ed, when we get into the home AV, is soundbars. Do you think actually people have gone soundbar and then realized, well, you know what, I could get away with some stereo speakers and HDMI arc into an affordable amplifier, and then I've got a far better two-channel system than a relatively affordable soundbar?
Yes, 100%. I think if you've been dealing with some of the soundbars which prioritize just being putting effects at the front, so whether they're just a genuinely stereo soundbar or something using virtual surround, you start thinking, actually, would it not be better to just to have two relatively decent speakers? And then, as you say, HDMI arc is the absolute magic ingredient here, because it doesn't change how the rest of your household uses the device. It still works exactly the same way as the soundbar did. It's no more challenging, it requires no more remotes, it requires no more thought, and it still functions in terms of day-to-day TV viewing in exactly the same way. And that is a magic sort of differentiation point. I then also think that when you've got the more complicated and sophisticated soundbars that come through with dedicated rear speakers and so on and so forth, then you start approaching it from the other end, going, well, actually, if I accepted that there might be some cabling that goes from the front to the back of the house. I could do this around an AV receiver and dedicated speakers, boost performance further, and have more say and more control over what I was connecting to my system. So soundbars have in some ways been a victim of their own success. They've got lots of people involved, and then a subset of those people have gone, I want something more, and both stereo amplifiers and then more dedicated AV solutions have started to get results based on that.
Yeah, fascinating. And fascinating to see the performance that we still get at £1,000. So if I give you a grand now, Ed, and I gave you the choice of you couldn't have anything over that price point, what's the one product that you are going to immediately go to in your circumstance?
I would be, that's a tough one. Presumably, I still have this not inconsequential collection of records off to one side.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just talking about you got a grand for an amp. Your circumstance, what do you pick up?
The Riga. I'm not going to lie. It doesn't do as many things. There's a whole video that I've recorded about this where this is, you're welcome to shout obscenities at the YouTube. Well, don't type obscenities, obviously. It's YouTube. Be nice to me. But you're welcome to violently disagree with me. On an objective level, the Audiolab is better than the Riga. It costs £100 less. It's got better connectivity. And it sounds really good. Unfortunately, the Riga, despite doing a bit less, is just the amplifier I want to spend more time listening to. And particularly when a record player is involved in that equation. The Audiolab's got a good phono stage. The Riga has a great one. So that, and I've been testing I've got a pair of relatively affordable Acoustic Energy A3092 floor standers here. There's a review of those going up on the site. They're a whisker over £1,000. We've got, in recent times, we've tested the Wharfdale Super Denton. We've tested all manner of things. I've got the new pair of Neat IOTAs, the revised version of those, coming to the site as soon as Neat can supply me a pair. There's plenty of sensibly priced loudspeakers that will just delight. The Riga has enough power to get them running, get them powered. And it's decent. That's the one I would do. But I wouldn't, to be very clear about this, I wouldn't be in any way surprised if you sat down and listened to them, or anyone else sat down and listened to them, when actually I do enough work with my television, I'd rather have the Arc of the Audiolab, or I'd rather save a bit of money and go for the Fell, because that's a cracking amplifier as well. Or you go, actually, do you know what? I want really good decoding. I want every input known to humanity. I want the Cambridge Audio. This is the great thing. What I want, actually, your choice of budget amplifiers was, well, you can have this one or this one, see which one suits you best. You've actually, you know, there's a meaningful crowd of the damn things now, and there's logical and sensible reasons to be picking any of them. And as I say, this has literally come about. It's been sometime in the making. I think when Audiolab launched the original version of the 6000, that was 2018, things started to really pick up from there. And now we're in a position where, you know, there's a genuine clutch of choices at the price point, and you would have to choose something based on the equipment you already have and what you need it to do. And there will be something that absolutely fits the bill.
Yeah, great amount of choice, reasonable cost as well. And like you say, I had some cracking products there. So we'll find a bit more. We'll try and put the links in the description on the YouTube video and also in the thread if you want to check out those reviews that Ed's already done or the ones that he's been talking about on there. Right, wrapping up on Hi-Fi for this month. Ed, your recommended album, vinyl and playlist.
Well, okay. I mean, it feels a bit surreal that there won't be too many more of these, but there's a bit of extra time here, so I can actually go on about these at slightly greater length. Recommended album, I oscillated on this, but my choice for this podcast is the latest album by a band called The Horrors. It's called Nightlife. It came out at the tail end of March. The Horrors have been around for quite a while, and they're one of those bands where you'll hear their songs and go, oh, so that's them. So without necessarily achieving enormous levels of commercial success, they've wormed their way into the public consciousness. And The Horrors, their latest album, it's just genuinely brilliant. It's one of those ones where you sit and listen to it and go, yeah, that's pretty good. And then you think, I'm going to listen to that again. And I'm going to listen to that again. And it just permeates its way in. Some hooky tunes. It's quite dark, but it's potent. It's got some go to it. Great vocals. It is naturally on all the major streaming services. You can buy it on all major physical formats, including cassette. And it would be my choice as a sort of general piece of listening. Vinyl's a little bit different. This could have been album of the month, but I think I'm going to say it's the vinyl for two reasons. One, I think the horrors is a more generalized and wider appeal thing. The other is that buying this band on vinyl has become something of a habit for me. So it's the latest album by a Manchester band called the Slow Readers Club. If you've read my reviews, I've been going on about them for donkey's years. They are genuinely one of the examples of something where Spotify went, you may also like. And whilst they would have earned very little from that stream, I've now been to see them twice, and I've bought all of their material in physical format. So it was worth them being on streaming services. Their latest album is called Out of a Dream. It was released the week before the Horrors album. I think it's fair to say that this is a band that's now settled into a slight sort of groove. They know what their fan base likes, fanatically loyal fan base, I have to say. It's one of those ones where you go along to the concert and everybody knows the words to every song. But nevertheless, if you like what they do, this is more of it. And I would also say that this is a band in a very modern setup. They have been with labels in the past, but for the most part, they release their material off their own bat. You'll see it's SRC Records, which is Slow Readers Club Records. These are self-financed, self-released records. So you wander off to their site and you buy it, they receive a very significant proportion of the money that's made on it. And I just think it's a very admirable model that they've been able to make that work and keep that going for as long as they have. So if you do buy this one on vinyl, shout out to going over to their website and doing it direct, not least because if you are of the mindset that you want it in lots of exciting colors and so on and so forth, you can choose ones on their website, which are not available anywhere else. Every other record I've ever bought from them has been an excellent pressing. My copy of this hasn't turned up yet because I waited for my credit card to roll over before I ordered it. But I have every confidence that it will be a decent one as well. And if you ever get the opportunity to see him live, it's slightly weird the first time because it's rare that you go somewhere where it's a crowd that's quite as devoted as these guys are, but it's really well worth doing if you can. And finally, playlist. I realize that almost everything I've done recently has been on Qobuz, mainly because Qobuz is very good at playlists. However, spring has sprung. It's sort of springing. It was very cold this morning, but it's getting a bit warmer out there. I found one called Spring Acoustic on Spotify. Will it rewrite your perception of music? No, it absolutely won't. Is it a genuinely pleasant listen to have on whilst you crack on with spring cleaning or just doing something productive? Yeah, it's really nice. So that was my recommendation for those things. As ever, if you don't use Spotify, and I have to be honest, there are creditable reasons in 2025 not to, you can use an app called Soundist to take the link from Spotify, which I can, of course, supply you, and you can create it in the streaming service of your choice.
One of your recommendations for a little while back, talking about Slow Readers Club, was Bear's Den.
Yes.
Ed, and that's a band I finally got to see live.
Oh, right.
2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
We saw them at Sage One, which is it's the Sage at Gateshead. It's now called the Glass House. I don't know why they changed the name. Fantastic venue. The acoustics are amazing in that venue. And they actually did two numbers where they walked away from the amplified microphones and so on. And stood at the front of the stage and sung the tune. And you would think you were sitting right next to them. We were right up the back, and the acoustics in the place were fantastic. So seeing them in a venue like that, and I've got to say live, they were super tight. They were. Yeah. It was like listening to the track on streaming or on CD or whatever. His voice is just so good.
Well, in a completely different approach, I went to see Orbital on Saturday
night. I'd love
night.
To see Orbital. I didn't know they were touring.
Trouser vibratingly loud. I'm very glad that I actually have earplugs with me all the time now. I only get one set of ears, and I face enough accusations of being deaf anyway, so I don't want to make it any worse. That was profoundly decent. And do you know who I'm going to see in early May? Well, no, obviously you don't, but think original contemporaries of Orbital, but rather less successful sort of length of career, I am off to see Utah Saints.
Oh,
so excellent. Yeah, there we go. Crossing another early 90s electronic
the Kate Bush samplers.
Yes. Well, I mean, the obviously the most amazing thing is trivia fact for you. There, if you go on Spotify, there are two Utah Saints albums. They have, in fact, created three. But one of them has never, ever, ever in any condition been released. It has so many samples and is such a licensing nightmare. It has never and may never see the light of day. It is one of those great lost works that humanity is the poorer for not having. So, yeah, I don't imagine I'll hear any of it when I go there. But no, I'm going to see the Utah Saints. I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. Well, you enjoy that, Ed, and we'll see you for more hi-fi next month. Thank you very much.
No worries. See you then.
So moving on to TVs, and I'm joined by our news writer, Ian Collin. Hi, Ian. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How is everybody else doing?
Yeah. Right. So what we're going to do in this section is obviously talk about Sony. Sony have initially, I went down to see them in March. We couldn't talk about them until the 2nd of April, which is now passed, but that was their embargo. They are launching their 2025 lineup of TVs, and some excitement and some disappointment in equal measure when it comes to their announcements. We're going to go through in a little bit of detail. Before we get into Sony, you probably have read my review of the LG G5. If you haven't, it's on AV forums. I encountered some issues with that TV, which I made quite public in our review and in our video. This is going out on the 14th of April, so it's early enough to let you know that I do have a beta version of a new firmware that LG have provided me on the feedback that I gave to them. That is being tested now, so you may, listening or watching this, want to check up again on the G5 review. It will be updated with the results of this new firmware. I've got another G5 sitting next to me here. I won't update the scores until we get a physical retail sample from Peter Tyson. Shout out to Peter Tyson. They've been absolutely fantastic recently supplying us TVs that are retail versions, so we can check what you guys are actually going out and buying. So if this firmware is up to scratch and it's doing everything as it should, and I can then confirm that in a retail version, we will revise the score. But until then, the score will remain as it is for that TV, because I do think that the flaws that we found, and it was us that found those in our review, written review that went out before everybody else found the same things. LG have reached out with this firmware. We'll see if it's fixed that. And if so, check out the review if you're watching this video after the 14th of April to see the results of that. And like I say, we'll get a retail set in. And if it's the same, we'll then revise the scores if they need to be revising. Right, let's get on to Sony. Like I say, Ian, lots to talk about, but actually not a lot of new things to talk about. And I think this is what's disappointed a lot of people out there. But I think we need to get into the detail, because there are some really interesting things in there.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those where they're kind of announcing new products, and the more you dig into it, it's kind of like, oh, actually, this is just a replacement for. So it's kind of an upgrade over with a different name, much as they renamed the Bravia 9, Bravia 8 OLED last year. It's kind of old models under new names. But, you know, obviously, there's still new technology coming in there. But yeah, it's not quite the whole new shebang that everybody might have been hoping for, especially with Sony touting some sort of new technology in recent months.
And this is the ironic thing. We've been banging on these podcasts about manufacturers shouldn't release things every year. They should give, you know, products time, because not everybody wants to renew their TV every year. So Sony have taken that approach. They're now doing it in 2-year cycles. So the first products that they renewed, which was, well, it was a new product, Bravia 9, we had Bravia 8, the OLED. They came out last time around as well as the Bravia 7 in 2024. So those three TVs continue into this year. They're on a 2-year product cycle. So this year, 2025, they are introducing new products to join that product cycle, and they will last for 24 months, and then they'll get renewed. And in the meantime, the top model should get renewed next year, if that makes sense. So Bravia 9 should get its update next year. The other one that's a possibility, we're not going to go into it here, because I don't believe in talking about prototypes in any meaningful way, because they are prototypes. So we're not going to get into the RGB LED TV, one, because I haven't seen it, two, because if it becomes a product, it's not going to be based on what people have seen, that those that have seen it. So that's likely to be Bravia 10, or it could be Bravia 9 Mark II. We just don't know. And because we don't know, and it's all speculation, we're not going to go there. We'll wait until there's something official to go on. We're not going to start the hype machine and talking about all these things that probably will never happen. So we're going to stick to what was announced. And this is where the controversy comes in, Ian, because they announced a Bravia 8 Mark II rather than a whole new Bravia 8 model. What was your take? I spent time with it. I'll do my talk about that. But what was your initial thoughts on that and the naming that they've gone with?
Yeah, well, I think with the naming thing, you kind of wonder whether they kind of boxed themselves into a hole a little bit with the numerical system, because obviously, traditionally, you have that structure where everything is kind of, there's a hierarchy. So the higher the number, the better the series, the bigger, the better the series. And so, you know, you've got the Bravia 9, the mini LED that they unveiled last year. You've got the Bravia 8 OLED. So when they come into effect, if you want to replace the A95L, you know, where do you put it? Do you put it above the mini LED? Do you put it, you know, so I don't know whether it's like a naming convention there, which kind of is holding them back a little bit as to where exactly they can put it. But yeah, I mean, if you're looking for something new, you would have thought, you know, it was going to be the A95 that gets the upgrade, which is what it's getting, albeit with a different name. Except, of course, the Bravia 8 Mark II is only coming in the 55 and the 65-inch sizes. So you will have to go back to the existing A95L if you do want that 77-inch size. Although I think it's the Bravia 8.
A95L at 77 inches continues to cover that space. But this is one of these frustrating things that Sony seemed to do. When I went to LA to see Bravia 9, the UK were only going to get 75 and 85 inch versions. We were not getting the 65, which seemed to be a big mishap there, because the American market were getting 65, yet they've got the bigger houses. But the UK with the smaller houses were only getting 75, 85. They rectified that one. This time around, Bravia 8 Mark II, I understand where they're coming from with this. I'm not 100% sure it's going to work. So the way it was explained to me was that they have their camera line. So you get the A7 Mark I, A7 Mark II, A7 Mark III. These are new models and so on. And this was the thinking for this TV. So Bravia 8 continues this year, which is a white OLED, a WRGB OLED. Bravia 8 Mark II is a QD OLED, and it's the upgraded model, and it's the one that's going to replace the A95L, which used to be the flagship model. But the A95L continues as a 77-inch. Are you confused yet? Because
I still haven't. I've been writing about this for the past two weeks.
Yeah, it does seem a little bit strange. So maybe Sony need to... I really like the simplification of the Bravia and then a number. I think that works great for the public, because you're not talking about XR90K, A95L, A95. You know, it does make it easier to follow until you then start having two products in the same lineup, like Bravia 8 and Bravia 8 Mark II. That can get confusing. And there's going to be a big price difference between Bravia 8 and Bravia 8 Mark II. So again, you know, that's going to cause some issues. But Bravia 8 Mark II, I've got to say, really impressed. I only had an hour. I didn't know I was going to get that hour with the TV. If I did, I may have been able to, you know, take some measurement tools and so on. As it was, I didn't have the opportunity to do that. I wasn't aware I was going to get that time with the TV. But I am thankful that I did get the hour with the TV and with two UHD Blu-rays that I know inside out, because I use them every single day, and that was Revenant and Pan. Awful film, but it's 4000 nit HDR. It has every possible scene that you could possibly want to test with, so it was ideal there. One of the things that really impressed me, and it's the same with the LG G5 and the Samsung A95F this year, is how it handles peak highlight detail, specular detail. It takes that 4000 nit image, and it will show back the areas where most TVs will clip, because they're not able to show that detail and that brightness. Bravia 8 Mark II can. Like I say, I couldn't measure it, but if you were asking me from the memory that I have in terms of having just seen LG G5 and spent a lot of time with it, and Samsung S95F, get these numbers right, then I'd say it's on a par. And then you've got Sony's processing on top of that. So I'm desperate to get this TV in for review because I think it's going to be one of the big hitters this year, especially if you're a movie fan. I think this TV offers, potentially offers, significantly better image quality than we've seen from Sony QD OLED so far. So that's actually got me quite excited, having spent that time with the TV. It could be that we end up with another G5 situation where you think, yeah, this is going to be fantastic. It's going to be TV of the year. And, we need to wait till we get it. So I'm not going to hype the TV up any more than I was really impressed. And I'm really quite excited to get it in for review because I think it has the potential to be one of the big hitters this year and one of the major TVs. So, and I'm always excited with OLED. I think it's a fantastic technology. So that's Bravia 8 Mark II. I'm going to mess up here with the model numbers. I'm sure the public are as well and so on. But Bravia 8 continues, so that is WRGB OLED. I've done the written review. There is a video review coming for that in the next week or so from my time spent with that. I've also got Bravia 7 in for review at the moment, which is the mini LED TV, which was launched tail end of last year. It continues this year, so it's still a very relevant TV. It's actually sitting on the floor at the minute. It's going up next after this G5 replacement goes. So look out for that review. And Bravia 8 Mark II, I am bugging them on a weekly basis at the moment for when's my sample coming. So as soon as we get one, you guys will know all about that. So that's the big TV. The other two are really quite interesting additions, Ian, and they are... one's a mini LED and one's a direct LED. So maybe tell us about those.
Yeah, the two, as the names will suggest, in terms of the sliding scale down, in terms of the naming hierarchy, the Bravia 5 is the mini LED. That will come in 55, 3-85 and 98-inch sizes. It's effectively replacing the X90L from last year. So presumably it'll have similar XR processor, the same kind of backlight master drive system as the Bravia 9, Bravia 7, and so on. Obviously, again, numerically and possibly specs and feature, not quite on a par with the 9 and the 7. And then dropping down a little bit further will be the Bravia 3, which, as you say, is the direct LED. I think I'm right in saying this is out in America.
Yeah, I saw
last
that
year, but
I did see it last year in LA, but it was for the US market only at that point. So, but
I don't
again,
know if we're expecting any changes from the US to the UK and Europe.
No, I think it's the same TV, to be honest with you. Same Google TV system on there as well. Obviously, it'll be regional. It'll be a regional variant of it. But I think Sony are realizing that they need to have some presence at that end of the market. So it's interesting to see them bring that in. And then there's a couple of carryover models from last year as well that do continue in between 3 and 5. So it's a long list of TVs that actually isn't that long if you're just looking at the new models that are being added. But I do like what Sony's doing in terms of 2-year product cycles, because I think the whole TV market's just gotten so not competitive, but it seems to be a new TV just for the sake of having a new TV every year. And in some years, there's very little in terms of real progress. There's maybe some marketing numbers, but nothing major improvement-wise. However, this year, we are seeing some big improvements. So you've got primary RGB tandem from the likes of LG, Panasonic, and Philips. You've got QD OLED fourth generation over a few models in Samsung's range. Although that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. And then obviously Sony also doing Bravia 8 Mark II. If you want to find out more details about Sony and you want to watch a full guided tour of the models and be able to see them on video, then Gavin McCarron from Sony Europe, I managed to get him on video. Our video's on the main YouTube channel. Go check it out. It's got my initial thoughts, having seen the products and being hands-on with the products, as well as Gavin giving you a full in-depth tour from Bravia 9 all the way down through the TV range. There was also some speakers and soundbars released as well. We've actually got them in for review right now. So Martin is busy reviewing those. So keep an eye on the homepage for the audio stuff. And like I say, as soon as we have the new models in, we'll get them reviewed TV-wise. And I've got Bravia 7 sitting here ready for review. And look out for the video review of Bravia 8. The written review is already on the website. And Bravia 8 Mark II It'll get done as soon as it's ready, and it's one of those TVs I'm dying to get on the bench there. Right, so Ian, thank you very much for your input on that one. And like I say, you know, keep an eye on the homepage at AV Forums on our YouTube channel. This is peak TV review season. All the new models are turning up. Our intention is to cover all the flagships, get them in side by side, do lots of comparison testing, do lots of comparison tests. And as you've already seen with the LG G5, you know, the way that we are doing the reviews now, it's very easy to pick up on any potential issues. It's easy to feed that back to manufacturers as well. And at the end of the day, you guys hopefully get a better product because we can spend a little bit more time reviewing these in the right circumstances and so on. So keep an eye on the homepage, subscribe to the main YouTube channel. Lots of video reviews and written reviews coming up of the new TVs. But yeah, thanks, Ian. We're going to move on to Home AV, and I'm joined by our reviewer, Martin. Hi, Martin.
Hi.
From Surround Group, we've got Neil Davidson. Hi, Neil.
Hi there.
Right, Home AV. We talked about subwoofers last time around. Hopefully you got something from that. We had lots of interaction on the videos and so on. So thank you very much for your questions on that. And hopefully you found the answers in the threads and other areas where those were asked. Right, so this week, we're talking about soundbars, but not in a way that you think we're going to talk about soundbars, because we've done that to death. But soundbars are a great way into the hobby. They are a way that people can find out about immersive audio, find out just how crap their TV speakers are. There's only less than a handful of TVs on the market where the inbuilt sound systems are half decent. And those are generally Philips TVs with Bowers & Wilkins sound, and the Panasonic TVs with Technic sound, and what Sony do with their screen surface audio. Everything else, the tiny little drivers, you can't beat the laws of physics, even when good DSP and so on, they really struggle. So just adding a soundbar makes such a difference to your experience with a TV. Martin's looked at a lot of the budget end. So very briefly, Martin, what, you know, if you're spending £100, you must be getting better audio than what's built into the TV. Even if it's a £3,000 TV, it's got to sound a little bit better.
Well, I'm not so sure, actually, Phil.
Okay.
I have a TCL C845 65-inch telly, and it sounds better than most of the cheap soundbars I get through the door.
Okay, well, there you go. But you're talking about a TV there that has quite a big chassis, if I remember the 845. So it's actually got a bit of air that it can move. And the drivers are quite, I think it's an Onkyo sound system on there, isn't it? Or Onkyo That's... branded. So so yeah, maybe I missed that one out in my little round there. But yeah, some TVs do sound good, but you're talking about generally higher end, or you're talking about mini LED TVs where the chassis are this size and you're able to fit half decent drivers and subwoofers in, and I'm saying subwoofers, but drivers into there that can add a little bit of bottom end and so on. But in general, you've looked at the cheap end. So if we're saying £100, not quite, where do you start noticing the difference?
Well, actually, my previous TV actually was an LCD panel that I had here that I was borrowing from a friend, and all the sound bars, even in the cheap end of the scale, improved the sound. Yeah. So yes, it does do it and can do it. And yes, if you're in any doubt, definitely try out a soundbar.
Yeah. So, you know, that's the first step on the run of the ladder, as it were. And Neil, this is the important thing. It's, you know, for me, it was an iCam VCR and a couple of speakers through a stereo with phono plugs. And I was, I was hooked at that point and I wanted to find out more. So a soundbar is the modern equivalent of that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we've had this discussion before. For me, it was my home theater in a box. And I think that that's probably where we're going to look at. So soundbar has become ubiquitous. It's easy to install. It's very attractive compared to a lot of speakers being dotted around, but it's not without its compromises as well, regardless of what budget you're willing to put into the whole thing.
And of course, that's what we're talking about here is budget. You know, you can come in at certain price points and you can keep going, Neil. You know, I've seen Lingdorf systems with
absolutely
soundbars that are tens of thousands. So a lot of it's going to come down to the aesthetic of the room. It's going to come down to what it is that you're looking for. And are you just talking about adding a soundbar just to improve the TV? or have you got a bigger goal in mind at the end of the day and how much money you got? But let's just use it as a stepping off point. So you've had your sound bar for a couple of years and you're now realizing, actually, there's something in this immersive audio. What's the next step, Martin, that you're going to direct somebody? Is it a better quality soundbar? Is it adding a soundbar with a subwoofer and surround speakers? What do you think? Or should they then at that point go to an AVR and separate speaker system? Or is that too big of a jump?
Yeah, I'd be inclined to go for a receiver. And I think there are so many really competent receivers now with incredibly good processing and relatively good and decent 5.1 speaker packages to go with them as well. I mean, I would absolutely 9 times out of 10, I would go for the 5.1 plus receiver option rather than a high-end soundbar. So if that means pushing out your budget just a little bit, maybe from £1,800 up to £2,500, you can do that really easily and satisfactorily, I would say.
Yeah. And I think I'm in that camp as well, Martin. That'd be the advice that I would give to somebody if they're looking for that. And I think the thing that sometimes we forget about now in this modern age of modern AVRs and so on is how integrated you can make everything. You know, I've got a Denon sitting here on the rack. Everything is plugged into that Denon. It's got 3 HDMI outs. I can feed 2 displays at the same time, so I don't need a video splitter. It's got built-in processing if you want it. The main thing for me as well is the ease of use in terms of switching from sources, switching inputs, EARC from the TV back to the AVR and so on. You're actually, Neil, opening up quite a wide array of things that you can then do when you add an AVR into the system.
Yeah, I mean, you open up a lot more opportunity when you're doing that. Just physical space is something that we've already touched upon as well. I also think what's really cool these days, so what you've described there, Phil, let's call that the classical AVR, that you would get and you would sit on a shelf and stuff like that. But even within AVRs now, there's been a really big change with these very compact 5.1 and 7.1 little integrated units, you know, that are that size.
Yeah,
I think that they are also very, very interesting because it opens up a better sound level, but without necessarily the big compromise in aesthetics or just, you know, where do I put this big box that you sometimes get? Let's say if you've got a Samsung frame TV with the control box, then an AVR that size is actually a thing that you can find in the marketplace these days.
Yeah,
and also those. I mean, I think Stuart was just putting up a picture of one of the JBLs. I think that's the MA310. And what a fabulous little receiver that is. I mean, it doesn't do much, hasn't got many features, but I think they've ploughed a lot of resources into the sound. They're a really good little family of AVRs, those.
Yeah. So Ian, as an outsider to this, you put the subject together for us on the running order today. But your role here is basically to ask the question of the listener or the novice or so on. So what are the things, what are the questions that pop in your head in terms of how you can progress your journey through soundbar and onwards?
Yeah, I mean, but the kind of the reason that the stuck in my head, and I don't know whether it's partly because of my own ignorance, because I'm not as aware of the industry as a whole and how things are perceived in the market as you guys are. But I mean, my sort of issue with soundbars, I don't know if it's because they're new, but I don't know if there's like a, not necessarily a stigma, but they're not really necessarily seen as being as attractive as, like, you know, obviously a full 5.1 system, or like the hi-fi guys will have their own kind of, you know, there's a certain style, a certain kind of elegance to having some cool hi-fi speakers. But soundbars, I think they're still pretty popular, and I think they're going to become increasingly popular as become more affordable and more accessible. And, you know, the plug and play simplicity of them, and the fact that you can just go down to your local store, pick one up for £100, plug it in, and it's going to make a difference. I think that's a big appeal. But I mean, I don't necessarily want to see them as just being like a middle ground between your TV and a better hi-fi sort of home cinema full system. I don't know, is that fair? Is that just me that's kind of seeing them as being that kind of a stepping stone rather than something that people could aspire to and maybe, you know, be happy to have a good soundbar system rather than thinking you've got to level it up?
Well, let's go to Neil. Neil, you're in the, let's say, the higher end of the market here. How would you answer Ian's question there?
Well, in fact, for those who want to have, let's say, the simplicity of a soundbar, but want to move a lot higher up in levels, there are a lot of interesting products in the market. And we've had this big discussion a lot. What's higher level? There's performance and there's aesthetics, and who's to say what's more important out of those things? There's a product that I know that Phil loves very much, the Canvas soundbar. Yeah. Is it a soundbar? Is it a big speaker? I don't know what it is, but it's very, very impressive. You know, and that's the sort of product I think is interesting, because it is a middle ground. You know, it is a middle ground design, that product. Very, very interesting. Now, those are one way to go. The other thing, and we were kind of joking about it before we came on air, we at the higher end are starting to see a new, is it a new category? I'll call it a new category of micro speakers. So very high end, beautiful manufacturing, all machined aluminium, all that type of stuff. You can't defy physics, but when you combine subwoofer and these little speakers, you can actually create a level of immersion that's absolutely compelling, wonderful clarity and all of those types of things in a nearly invisible system. So, you know, that's another different, complete way of looking at it. You know, if you want to do a micro system like that, yeah, you could easily spend 20,000-25,000 on such a system. And the way that you see people using those types of systems, it's not just to sit and listen to music or anything, that's soundscapes and all of this amazing technological stuff that comes these days. One of the things we've discussed so many times in these podcasts, though, is we need to have these sort of stepping stones for people. And that's where I think the soundbar is still the on-ramp. You've got your middle products that you've just mentioned. And then we move up, you know, and you've got the guy that wants his big tannoys that are, you know, the size of a house. Beautiful things. They wouldn't work in my living room, but, you know, beautiful things. And then you have another guy who, for the same money, wants to put little teeny jeweled boxes all over the place. And I think that's what's interesting about the business and where we are at this minute in time. You do have a lot of choices.
So, and again, we're getting back to the, you know, what got us into this hobby in the first place. It was that first sort of living with immersive audio. And we've come so far in quite a short space of time with that, with, you know, the processing power that we now have in a lot of these products in terms of DSP and so on, and what you can actually do with speaker drivers and subwoofers and hide things away. And the choice, Martin, is actually pretty endless. It's going to come down to, where do you want to go? Once you got the bag, it's about what you want to create. And I guess there's lots and lots of choices out there, and there's not one right answer.
No, there really isn't. But, you know, I mean, I think a lot of soundbars make the soundscape very TV-centric. And the thing is, with moving to the small receiver option, is that you really do get a feeling of being immersed. With that said, somebody who does want to get onto the ladder and cares also about the aesthetics and whether something can marry up well to their TV in terms of looks, there are some beautiful soundbars out there. I mean, there are some very nice devices. And yes, of course, they will improve a kind of sense of spaciousness. I don't know how good a lot of them really are at that. I mean, some of them have a little bit of a effect of height effect, if you like, coming, bouncing off the screen a bit. But yeah, to get the real immersive thing, I think you've got to go towards the separates route. But yes, I think there are a lot of options for everyone, and there are so many directions in which you can go. And the other thing with soundbars, of course, is you don't necessarily have a path to upgrade. If you do go down the route of AVR plus 5.1 set of speakers, you can upgrade any component in that as you go.
Yeah, and that's one of the beauties of going that route. So leaving the soundbars behind now, and let's look at some of the alternatives. But one thing I want to do before we leave soundbars is that I don't want to leave the impression that soundbars are not very good, because as Neil's touched on, that some of them are absolutely phenomenal. But they're a little bit further up in the market, but some of them really do work in terms of aesthetic, but also sound quality. That Canvas that you mentioned, Neil, I've got two Bowers & Wilkins 702S3 floor standers in that same room. The difference in the audio quality there is a difference, but it was not as great as you would think. You know, £7,000 floor standards to a £4,000, £3,000soundbar, there was not a great deal of difference. And if you don't want the Hankin floor standards there, in that case, the canvas really did work with its DSP, you know, making it sound like this, you were listening to two speakers and so on. So there are products out there that do that. The other product I need to touch on, because I think it really is the goat when it comes to soundbars. Sorry for using that terminology, but you know, youngsters, we need to get them listening. Is Samsung. Samsung knock it out of the park with their 990. I think we're on to 990F now in terms of models. But you're getting surround speakers, you get a soundbar, amplifying, nice subwoofer. And for the money, that thing really does the business. It sounds great. And if that's all you want is that bit of immersion, a bit of sound bouncing off the ceiling to give you the sense of height and so on, and the subwoofers are really good quality for what you're getting there, you know, yeah, that's a great system. And if you're at £100 and you want to have a jump up, well, there you go, that's your next step, jump into that. And then if you enjoy that and that's doing it for you, then think about your aesthetics and everything else. But then, you know, what's the next step, what's the next jump off from that point? So let's look at the alternatives. Martin, you made that a great point there about moving to an AVR, because you get that separation. Because if your soundbar sits underneath the TV, even at 65 inch wide TV, it still doesn't give you a great deal of stereo separation. You have to be sat really in a sweet spot there to get any kind of separation. So I guess the first step up from a soundbar fairly would be a pair of stereo active speakers, to give you that little bit wider sound stage either side of the TV or a little bit wider.
Yeah, and again, for the price, I mean, if you're just picking a figure out of the air, like £2,000, you can get an incredible pair of active speakers. A lot of them come with HDMI now and HDMI eARC or ARC, so they're fully compatible with TVs. The manufacturers are wise to all this now, that what they're making are AV components in effect. But yes, that's a very good point. I think my next step would be that. And in fact, I have a very good pair of powered speakers, which I don't have room to fit around the TV at the moment, but I would love to do that.
You see this, Neil? Active speakers. We were doing this years ago with Genelecs and Marquees and
I keep my powered speakers either side of my screen here,
yeah.
Phil. My
Yeah. No, I've got a couple of Genelecs up here. Yeah.
They've got a lot of miles on them these days,
Yeah.
but they'll not be going anywhere.
But in all seriousness, we were so far ahead of our time back then, weren't we? When we were saying to people, you know, Marquees, Genelecs, the amplifications sorted with the driver, you're getting a certain level of performance, five of them, and they're not huge speakers, five of them dotted around the room, a subwoofer, and you're pretty much set.
Well, the thing that if you look at a soundbar, and we mentioned that Samsung one, and I wanted to jump in on this, the incredible amount of resource that gets spent on optimizing that
Yeah.
product, and it has computing power inside it, that thing. You know, they all joke about it would have taken men to the moon. It probably would have taken them to the moon and back again. The amount of sound processing power those types of products have in them, and of course, a lot of that is about defying physics. So if you can take that processing and just make the physics a bit easier as well, it's pretty inevitable that you're going to get a much better performance. And I think that that is something that an active speaker will always have the advantage that it's made as a system compared to trying to match pieces together.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's your next route, or possible next route. You want to get a bit of stereo separation. You want a little bit better quality in terms of what you're getting. And another big area, it's unfortunate that Ed can't join us for this section of the podcast, but it's one that we've discussed in the past, is hi-fi components. Now, you buy any streamer or any amplifier over a certain price point, usually about £500 and more, you get an eARC. That was unheard of in hi-fi circles just a few years ago. They all have it now, because the realization there is that you add a decent amplifier with eARC, a couple of speakers, that's so much better in terms of quality than any soundbar that you can go out and buy for the equivalent money. So let's take that one step further. Neil, the problem I think a lot of people are going to be shouting at the whatever they're watching or listening to this podcast on is that my other half, significant other, will in no way have floor standers or massive speakers in the house, never mind 15 subwoofers for waveforming and all the rest of it. So what is the solution for people who have the bug and who have gone past the soundbar and they're not really wanting to go two-channel, they want the full immersive experience? What choices do they have?
Well, so again, I think that we had a good discussion about this middle of last year that people can go back and have a look at as well. When we speak about architectural speakers, so an architectural speaker used to be a horrible bad word that people would go, oh, rotten. But that is long ago, not the case anymore. I guess a lot of people may not realise that you can get fully invisible speakers now. So what they do is they will use plasterboard or some other membrane and they vibrate just the way that the Sony works that you mentioned at the start of this discussion. So you get a very big sound field from a panel speaker, not hi-fi, but it's a very convincing sound field. And if you don't want to see it, it doesn't get better than that. But then you move into things like in-wall speakers and you get in-wall speakers. I mentioned micro speakers really of, you know, 100 millimeters by 30 millimeters, tiny things, all the way up to, you know, 2.5 almost meter tall speakers. So there's a wide range of options for people that value sound quality, but don't necessarily, for aesthetic or space or myriad other reasons that people have, don't want things to clutter up the floor in their room. Plenty of options these days.
Yeah. So I guess we've covered most of the angles that you need to cover there in terms of moving on from a soundbar. And what is it, Neil, that you think is the end goal here in terms of getting the absolute best in terms of quality? Are we still talking about, you know, the full-on traditional approach where we go to, how many channels are we on now? 42, 46, 48, as many as you like.
But
is that still an end goal for a lot of people? Or do you think there has been a shift in what people are aiming for in terms of the end goal? I mean, the end goal for me will always be, if I won the Euro Millions tomorrow, it would be a DCI cinema built in a dedicated space with, you know, whatever is going to achieve what I want to achieve, which is the ultimate in cinema sound. But that's not everybody's end goal. Or is it? You know, is that traditionally the end goal, or has it changed?
No, I think that that's one of the biggest things that's changing in the market these days. And I think that that is important to understand because it does change from a manufacturing perspective what you want to do, but also from a consumer perspective what you want to do. So if we talk about that big DCI cinema, look, there's no replacement for displacement. You know, let's use a cliche where it fits. A big speaker with a big woofer with 1,000-watt amplifiers is just going to hit a lot harder and sound better than pretty much anything. And if it's big and, you know, black and rectangular boxy, who cares? You know, that's what it is. And I think that everyone probably can understand that at a sort of an intellectual level. You know, you've maybe not experienced it, but it's pretty obvious that that's going to give the best experience, I think. Where for me it becomes much more interesting is you talk about media rooms or lifestyle rooms. So I always use my example of my own house. I have a beautiful glass sunroom that we did on the house, and I love to sit in there. That's my favourite part of my house that I love to spend time in. Now, of course, one of the downsides of building a glass room, including the roof, incidentally, is that it's not very easy to fit high-quality audio into that. And my usage of audio in that space would be totally different. We have a TV in there, so sometimes we watch TV, but a lot of the time I'm sitting, I'm reading a book, or, you know, I'm watching the world go by with the sun on my face in a room like that. And there, maybe it's some music, but maybe it's a sound field that I like to listen to. And if people have not probably been exposed to sound fields, but this is like the next wave of thing that's coming, of synthesized sound experiences. If I want to pretend I'm at the beach, I can press beach and it sounds like I'm at the beach. the waves are lapping along the ground because I have speakers at low level, and then a bird flies overhead, or I hear people off in the distance, or whatever else. It's uncanny, and I need at least 12 speakers to do that, and preferably 15, 16. But it's not laid out like an Atmos system by any means, and that's where we need micro speakers, because I don't have space to put all of this other stuff. Necessity is the mother of invention. I can also confirm that for everybody.
Yeah.
So we're seeing a lot of that type of stuff, where the change that people are doing in their living style is leading to innovation in audio products. I think that that's probably the best way I would say it.
Yeah, yeah. Exciting stuff. And of course, we'll continue following this as it progresses, like we have done for the past 20-odd years and so on. Before we wrap up on home AV, some big news recently, Neil. You're in this sector of the market, so maybe we can get some comment, even though you do distribute a competing manufacturer. But Sony have run into a few issues with their projectors recently. Falling foul of regulations in Europe, shall we say, in terms of sanctions and so on, in terms of where they're sourcing some components. It's been a bit of a shocker, that one, in terms of suddenly not being able to distribute the products in the EU.
Well, I mean, it clearly was a shocker for those partners of Sony. It could be debated that it was perhaps a little bit surprising that Sony didn't recognise that might potentially be a problem a bit sooner, that they had to just cut it like that.
Yeah.
Now, I don't believe it affects one of the models, the very top end, the GTZ, but it seems that everything else has been affected by that. Now, look, that's obviously very unfortunate. A lot of people that we know, either as suppliers of Sony or as customers of Sony, are directly impacted by something like that. I don't personally know all of the details, I'm sure you can appreciate, but it does seem very, very unfortunate for those guys that they got caught so, so cold with something like that. At the same time, well, I guess everyone's political viewpoint might be different, but you know, those sanctions are in place and Sony really had no choice but to comply with those sanctions. So whilst it was abrupt, they have also taken very decisive action.
Yeah,
that you can deny that, to make sure that they also comply.
Yeah.
So, you know,
and you can bet your bottom dollar or your nosediving dollar, whichever way you see it, as they're going to have to figure it out and fix it, because that's a huge sector of the market that they can't just overnight do without, isn't it? So it's something.
Well, but the question is, for Sony, does it make sense? Because my understanding is that that's related to patents and stuff like that, and within the manufacturing chain, does it make sense for the level of revenue that the projectors generate as part of the whole global Sony picture? And remember, it's only Europe and UK. The whole rest of the world is unaffected pretty much by this whole thing. America is not affected by this, for example. Does it make sense for them to change it? Or do they just say, well, there's a 0.01% of our business that we just do something else in?
Yeah. Well, I thought it'd be interesting to get your point of view, seeing that that is your market, Neil, and you know, we've all read the stories. Well, there's a story on AV Forums as well, covering the news. But from that sector of the market, is it still a you said like 0.1% or whatever of the whole Sony thing, but is it still a big market, projectors? Are they still the big screen thing, even though micro LED seems to be, you know, gaining momentum?
For those that don't know, I'm very invested in that market. I own a projection screen company and we sell projectors. So, you know, we're definitely on that side of the business. Now, there's no doubt that things are changing. Okay. As TVs get bigger, you know, why would you spend £4,000-£5,000 on a projector and a screen when you can get a TV for that money? And I know that that's a very simplistic viewpoint. Once you start to go over that sort of 120-inch level, TV doesn't really become an option. You start to look at LED walls. Now, people might be surprised to know an LED wall starts at about £27,000-£28,000 these days. It's not the infinity money. Of course, we still do them at that level, but, you know, it's not what it used to be in terms of unobtainium. 27,000 mean there's going to be top end JVCs, and certainly the Sonys were way above that price point. Again, so that's a different experience. You know, where do you put the speakers? You maybe take 1080p instead of 4K at that level. So we still see very, very strong demand for projectors that are fulfilling kind of the niche above where TVs go. And for people that are not able, for all of those different reasons, to go into very high-end LED wall. Now, look, for me personally, there's one thing that a projector will always be able to do. It will always be able to converge white, and no fixed pixel display will ever be able to converge white the way that a projector can. So the perception of sharpness that you can get is, look, for me, is unrivaled with those things. So still a lot of life in projection, still a lot of innovation happening in projection, we're very happy to see. I don't want to take over with brands and all that type of stuff, but we're involved with some exciting new releases that are going to be happening in the next few months, where projection has really moved forward over the last year.
Neil, don't you find though, and sorry, this is going into it in another area, I guess, of potential depth, but don't you get the feeling that a projector in a dark room produces a much more what you might describe as a restful image?
Oh, yeah, sure. There's no doubt about it. Absolutely. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, I think we'd all agree that, you know, depending on where you're coming from in terms of your background and so on, you give me a choice of 120-inch TV or you know, 160-inch projection screen and projector, a high-quality projector, I'm going projector every day. If it's for watching films, movies, I'm going projector every day at the minute. As good as TV is, as good as these micro-LED screens are and so on, and the HDR effect and everything else, for me, at this moment in time, projection's still, you know, the goal, I think, for movie fans and those that want a much...
It comes back to the way that people are using spaces, right? If you've got that dedicated space, it's a no-brainer. As soon as you move out of that dedicated space, like, I'm not going to put a projector in my sunroom, for example. That actually is where a lot of media consumption happens for people these days. The death of the dedicated room is very much exaggerated, though. And there, for sure, the projection has a lot of life left in it. And if you see a projector at 300 nits, let me tell you, that's also quite an impressive sight.
Yeah, I mean, one of the best Dolby Vision demos I ever had was at Dolby in their demo room at Soho. And it's, this is black. No, this is black. And you just think, oh, okay. And that's a projector. Yeah. So, yeah, I think there's still a lot of life left in it. But thanks for your comments on that one, Neil. That wraps it up for this month's podcast. My thanks to Neil, Martin, Ian, and of course Ed for his hi-fi roundup. The final episode before we take a break on this podcast will be Monday the 12th of May, so mark that in your diaries. Will be video and audio only, full-length video, full-length audio only. And like I say, we're going to look back at over the last 20 years. We've been doing the podcast 20 years. We're going to look back, look at all the technical changes, look at formats like HD, DVD, and other things that came and went in that time, where we are now compared to where we used to be. We're going to get into all of that in the next episode. Screen Time from AV Forum still hangs around, and it will be around for some time yet to come. The movie guys will be giving you all the roundup of 4K discs, movie releases, streaming, all that kind of thing. So go and subscribe to the Screen Time AV Forum's YouTube channel for all the videos that those guys do. And of course, the audio only version will continue to happen on the fourth Monday of every month going forward. So make sure you subscribe and tune in for that. And if you do want to give us a bit of support and so on, you can do that. You can buy me a coffee.com/AV Forums. You can become a patron. We're going to do lots more in terms of video, lots of exciting stuff coming up in the very near future in terms of that, like this room We're going to get a deep dive into the room that we've built here with Neil and his assistants. We've got some stuff to talk about with Neil as well in terms of some new product and so on. So we're going to get into that. Review-wise, we've got loads of reviews coming up. Lots of TVs sitting on the floor here or on the bench here getting tested. Like I say, stay tuned to the main AV Forums webpage, the main homepage for all of the reviews as they're released. And of course, the video reviews will be on our YouTube channel as well. I'm Phil Hinton. Thank you very much for watching and listening, and we'll see you next month. Goodbye.